Marcel did his PhD at Cambridge back. He finished it in 2013. Then he did a postdoc at Berkeley, and then second postdoc is here. Should I say Berkeley, or is it? Yeah, I guess it's in Berkeley, which is Berkeley Center for Cosmological Physics. And then the second postdoc is at IIS. So Marcel works on modeling various analytic techniques to model nonlinear structure formation, as well as detecting various signatures of nonlinear structures in the microwave background, amongst other exciting cosmological projects. And today he's going to tell us about CMB lensing axis of the cross correlations.
Okay, thanks a lot for the kind introduction. And yeah, I'm very happy to be here. It's my first time here, and I'm really enjoying the visit so far. I'll talk about two recent things that I've been working on. The first half of the talk will be about these cross correlations between CMB lensing and galaxy clustering, and some forecasts how well this might work in the future. And then in the second half of the talk, I'll discuss how we might be able to reconstruct linear initial conditions from the observed galaxy catalogs that some of the future galaxy surveys are going to produce. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with Tobias Baldauf, Urs Selchuk, and Matthias Salderiaga. Okay, let's get started. As you all know, the oldest light that we can observe is the cosmic microwave background radiation back here. Now, the photons from that microwave background don't travel to us on straight lines because there's dark matter between us and the CMB. So the photons get deflected, and they move on these non-straight lines. This deflection by the dark matter is what we call CMB lensing, right? So what we see is not this unperturbed. We don't see this original image of the CMB, but we see some perturbed version where the radiation is remapped depending on what kind of structures there are in front of this. To illustrate a bit more what this is doing, I stole these slides from Blake Shervin, where you can see a 10 by 10 degree patch of CMB temperature fluctuations if there was no lensing, so if there was no dark matter between us and the CMB. And then this is what happens if the lensing is in front of it. So it's a very small change. I'll flip back and forth a few times so you can see it, right? And you notice what basically happens is that on these kind of degree scales, the fluctuations get moved in a coherent way around, right? Right. So yeah. So that's basically what this CMB lensing is doing. Now, with ongoing CMB surveys are of course getting really nice, and so this is something like what Planck is observing, right? So we have not just this one 10 by 10 degree patch, but we actually have many of these patches that we can observe in the CMB, right? And so you can do statistics of this, right? And the typical thing that people look at is the global power spectrum of that CMB, where you see that famous acoustic peak at 1 degree scale, and then more oscillations here, right? Now we can ask, what happens if you look at these individual 10 by 10 degree patches, right, and you measure the local power spectrum in these patches? If there's no lensing, then the local power spectrum is the same in each patch, right? Because the universe is isotropic and homogeneous, so you always see the same local power spectrum, and there's always this peak at 1 degree angular scale. Now, if we add lensing, or if we add dark matter in front of that, then some of these regions will get magnified and others will get demagnified, right? So for example, here, if you have some galaxy in front, what you might see is that so everything would get magnified, right? So this basically the structures would look bigger, so the on angular scales, this would move to the left. You would see the peak further to the left. If there's some demagnification, the opposite would happen.
So right. Identical to
me. Yeah, sorry, this is no lensing, right?
Okay.
So now I add lensing.
Yeah,
right. Right, so this is when you add lensing. So basically, and sorry, the quality of the picture is not very nice, but what you can see is that in different patches, that peak is kind of either going to the left or to the right, depending on how many galaxies you have in front, if you have a void or some galaxy in front, right? Now, if you again measure the global power spectrum of that lensed CMB, what you get is you get this peak smearing here, right? Because basically you see different, well, you see different power spectrum in different patches, right? And in each patch, the power that peak is either a bit high or a bit low. So once you average over everything, you kind of like you increase your error bars. You don't bias anything because the mean of the lenses is zero, but you increase the variance of that peak, and that leads to that smearing of the acoustic peaks. And the amount of smearing is basically given by the dispersion of that. How much it fluctuates around the mean in the different patches. Okay, so that's one effect of CMB lensing, right? It smears out the peaks in the CMB temperature power spectrum. And this has been detected with about 10 sigma or so with Planck. But you can, if you're after the...
It's theoretical. So namely the lensing that you do is something that you put in theoretically.
Yes, that's right. So this is theoretically. So we basically we can write down a model how the dark matter fluctuations look like in the late time universe, and we can use that to predict how much of that smearing happens. But it's also been seen in observations. So it's so it's theoretically predicted and then confirmed in the observations.
Okay. So can you tell which patches are?
That's right. So that exactly. That's what I'm getting at, right? So So here you see this like this effect where you smear out, but you don't know where it comes from. But yeah, you could do something more clever where you're saying, let's look for that modulation, right? And if you measure that modulation, you can say something like where the lenses should be, right? And that's exactly what people do, and this goes under the name of you can measure that modulation, and that's called quadratic estimator lensing reconstruction. So basically, you kind of look like you look at these small scale modes, and you see how they are shifted around, and that tells you something about the large scale lenses. And you can do this in some optimal way to really get a map of what the lens distribution looks like. And the first time this was done on real data was actually by Kendrick Smith, who's teaching right now. So I made the slide just for him, but so right. So what he did is he with Oliver Sahn and Olivier Doré, they took WMAP CMB data. They did this lensing reconstruction where they look for the modulation in different patches, and they cross correlated with radio galaxies, and they find this few sigma cross correlation here. Right, and this was the first proof that this really happens in the universe. Now this was 2007. Now the data has become much better, right? So, for example, Planck has cross-correlation signals with different galaxy surveys, and each of these cross-correlation measurements is around 20 sigma, right? So these are like really high signal-to-noise measurements now. So what I'm going to talk about in the rest of this part of the talk will be how this will develop in the next couple of years. Right, so and the motivation is basically if you ask which redshifts is the CMB lensing probing, if we take it as a signal, it's probing kind of this redshift out to the CMB, and it peaks kind of half the distance to the CMB, which is around redshift 2. Right, and what galaxy surveys are probing is kind of lower redshift, but as these galaxy surveys get deeper and deeper, they also probe higher redshifts. So we hope to fill in that empty area here where the CMB lensing is sensitive to, right? So from that, we expect that these cross-correlation signals become better and better in the near future.
So why is it a big redshift of 2 for the CMB lensing?
You shouldn't look at this in redshift, but I guess in gigaparsec, in physical units. And then, so this is like, I don't know, 14 gigaparsec, and then 7 gigaparsec would be kind of redshift 2. So so if you take the right units, then it's about half halfway to the CMB. So the lensing basically picks up most contributions half the way to your source plane. It's how the
You're asking why, right?
I'm asking why. Okay,
so you're asking why.
Is it like a peak in the formation?
Sorry?
Is there like some peak in the formation of the lensing?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I mean, what you can work, I mean, you can work out like you can work out how the lensing happens, and there is some kernel that that is kind of maximized half the way between the source and yourself. But I'm not sure if there's an intuitive explanation for that. That might
part of it is the structures are forming at later redshift. So, but part of it is also that you need some large enough distance for lensing to.
Well, yeah, I mean that statement that you're most sensitive to half the way to the source plane. I think that's always true, right? So most structure is always at low redshift, but then the stuff you're probing is like that's halfway.
Is that like but, I wanna like naively match it to like a strong lensing kind of phenomenon, the way that the CMB images project the halfway, something like that.
At
the distance, or
yeah, I'm not sure.
Usually, I'm thinking there's something, light's coming, and there's a source, and then it gets lensed. So maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we can chat later. I need to look it up if there's some intuitive explanation for that. But, all right. Right. Okay. So I guess all I wanted to say is that seamless lensing is probing that kind of redshift range, and with Galaxy Service, we are trying to get to these high redshifts, trying to cover the similar redshift range. If we can do that, and if we can measure these cross correlations better and better, we can do a lot of cosmology with that. So for example, we can measure the matter amplitude sigma h as a function of redshift. So that tells us like how much structure there is at different redshifts. Then we can measure from that, we can kind of measure the expansion history and dark energy, how fast things expand. We could use that maybe to measure some of neutrino mass. And one thing that I'm going to go into a little bit more detail is that we can also use this to constrain inflation and by measuring primordial non-Gaussianity. And finally, we can measure galaxy bias and maybe learn something about galaxy formation from that. Right, so just to drive home that point, the cross correlations we can do, there are many of them, right? So these are kind of future CMB lensing experiments, or future CMB experiments that can do these CMB lensing measurements. So there's advanced active SPD3G, which are they have their data. Basically, Simons Observatory is funded and will start soon, and CMBS4 is a proposed experiment. That's not funded yet, but in the proposal stage. And these here are our galaxy surveys. This year is already going on. This will start in a year or so. And also these will also start in the next couple of years. I will look at a pretty futuristic combination of these. So I will look at CMB stage 4 cross-correlated with LSST.
Question. You had a question mark next to a spherix. Is it suspended or is it?
Right. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know why it disappeared. Okay. Yeah. So it's so they had like a first round and then they didn't get selected. And talking to them, so the criticism they got was that they did too much science. So then they were really annoyed by that. But they also got the. They were also told that they should submit again in a kind of bigger mission. So that's what they're doing now. So and they hope to get into that. So So I think they are still very optimistic that they might get funded. Yeah.
Are they going to cut the science?
No, I think they'll do even more. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I guess kind of what they were saying maybe was there was too much science for the budget they were asking for. I don't know. So like now they have even more money to. I don't know. It was too much science per dollar. I don't know. Yeah, so that would be really cool if that happens. So, yeah. Okay. Right. So. So as I said, I will do this kind of futuristic thing where I do forecasts for cross correlations of CMB stage 4 with LSST, which we might be able to do in like 2025 or like 7-8 years or later. Right. And the kind of point of view that I'm taking here is I assume that all our models work for how these signals look like. And I assume that we can mitigate all systematics, right? And I assume that CMB stage 4 and LSST will actually deliver what they promise. And then I will ask, what can we hope for, right? So it's kind of a very optimistic kind of viewpoint, right? But I just want to see, like, what can we possibly hope for, right? So this is the number density that I assume in these forecasts for LSST, right? So you get something like 40 galaxies per square minute at low redshift, which is kind of optimistic, but we only need these galaxies in pretty broad redshift bins because we are cross-correlating with steam relensing, right? So it's, the requirements on these galaxies are less stringent than for some of the other LSST signs, where, for example, if they do galaxy shear lensing measurements, they have to see images of the galaxies and look at their elliptical shear. So for that, you need very high quality, of course. But here, we just need the galaxy positions, and we only need to know their redshift very approximately because we are cross-correlating with the CMB, which is pretty constant in each of these redshift bins. And then we also add galaxies at high redshift that are, I'll say a little bit more about that, but that's also maybe optimistic. If we do that, though, so if we use that kind of optimistic LSST number density, we get this cross-correlation coefficient between CMB lensing and galaxy clustering, right? So what you can see here is basically the LSST galaxies at redshift zero to 0.5 are 70% correlated at large angular scales with the CMB conversions that can be measured with CMBS4. Right, then as you go to higher redshift, that kind of maximum correlation goes to smaller angular scales. What you can do then is you can add these galaxies together and you weight them in such a way that you trace the CMB lensing kernel, right? And that gives you that curve up there where you get this combined correlation coefficient where you combine all the galaxies together in one map and then cross-correlate that with CMB lensing. And the cool thing is that you get something like 95% correlation on these large angular scales, right? So that means you're measuring pretty much the same structures in two different experiments, right? One is the LSST galaxies, and the other one is the CMB lensing from CMB stage 4. And that's really cool because what we can do with that is we can try to do a sample variance cancellation, right? Let me explain what that is about. So just look at the upper panel for now. Imagine that CMB lensing power spectrum is this black line here, which fluctuates around that around one, right? And the galaxies are tracing the same structures, right? So let me assume that there's 100% correlation coefficient between CMB lensing and galaxies. Then the fluctuations are exactly the same in these maps, but the galaxies are biased, right? So here they have like a bias of 2, basically. So galaxy power spectrum is just 2 times the CMB lensing power spectrum. Now, if you wanted to look for deviations between the two on large scales, you would always be limited by that cosmic variance that's shown in the shaded area, right? However, if you look at the ratio between the two curves, you can measure that with infinite precision, basically, right? So if you have these two curves and you take the ratio, you will find out that one is just 2 times the other, and that factor of 2 can be determined with no error bar, basically, right? It's like it's infinite precision. So one way to exploit that is if you look at primordial non-Gaussianity that's generated by multifield inflation, because that has a very nice signature where it biases the galaxies on large scales, but it doesn't change the CMB lensing, right? So now you can look at the lower panel where there is this primordial non-Gaussianity turned on. CMB lensing is the same as before, but the galaxy clustering has this large scale bias that scales like 1 over L squared, right? So if you have cosmic variance within these shaded areas, you wouldn't be able to distinguish these two curves, or you wouldn't be able to distinguish that from that, right? But if you look at the ratio of the blue over the black, you can see that it's always 2 here. And here it's 2 with this 1 over k squared happening at low k, right? And again, you can measure that with zero error bar because the fluctuations are exactly the same, right? The up and down wiggles are the same.
So this is up to the shot noise.
Exactly. Exactly. So
but here you're assuming there's no
shot noise. So here, yeah, this is a cartoon where I assume no noise. So okay. I assume 100% correlation between CMB lensing and galaxy clustering. Exactly. But so the thing that's limiting this in practice is that there's always stochasticity or noise in these things, right? And that's shown here, right? So because of shot noise and CMB lensing reconstruction noise, we don't get 100% correlation, but we only get 95% correlation. And that, I mean, there's no way around that, right? So that tells us like how well the sample variance cancellation is working, right? And if you like if you go through a forecast, like how it works, the scaling is basically that your signal to noise on FNL scales like 1 over 1 minus the correlation coefficient squared. So if your correlation coefficient goes to 1, denominator becomes 0, so you divide by 0, so your signal to noise becomes infinity. If you have 95% correlation, you get like factor few improvement. Right, that was the reason why I showed this plot, right? The improvement we get from sample variance cancellation is really given by how close to 100% we get here. Now, one thing that you can also see from that plot is that we have these galaxies at redshift 4 to 7, and if we didn't have those, we would get a hit by like 5 to 10% on the total correlation coefficient, right? And I guess I had a slide, but let me skip that. But so we what we included are these dropout galaxies at high redshift, right? And this is something that's that can be done with these imaging surveys. Basically, what they do is they have these broad bands of photometric They can look for galaxies that appear in some bands but disappear in the other bands, and that can be used to detect galaxies at redshift above 4. So they look for Lyman break in the galaxy spectrum. And there was a very nice recent paper by HSC called where they did a Gold Rush program, is what it was called, where they found 500,000 of these high redshift galaxies at redshift 4 to 7 in only 100 square degrees of observations. So if you scale that up to the basically half the sky that LSST is going to observe, you get something like 100 million galaxies at redshift 4 to 7. Right, and here I'm assuming something like 50 million galaxies at redshift 4 to 7. So, but that's kind of, I guess, it's an unknown how well we can use these galaxies, right? So it's not well known what's the number density, I guess. I think there's a lot of motivation to look more into that within LSST. Just going on with these forecasts, right? These are kind of the power spectra that we would expect from CMBS4 correlated with LSST. Here are galaxy autospectra, and the shaded regions show the noise. So you see, and the noise is also showing here in dashed. So you see, we're signal dominated out to L of 2000 or so. CMB lensing is signal dominated up to L of 1000. With CMB stage 4. So you get this this huge signal to noise in that regime up to L of 1000. The cross correlations are also very high signal to noise. Right? So if you just look at the numbers, basically the CMB lensing auto power spectrum is something like 400 sigma. The LSST auto spectra are around 500 sigma if you go to L of 1000, and almost 1,000 sigma at L max of 2,000. Cross correlations are also a few hundred sigma. So these are huge signals that will be there. So then we do a Fisher analysis where we include all the power spectra I just showed. And let me just show you the final result that we get for primordial non-Gaussianity. So this is showing the constraint on this primordial non-Gaussianity amplitude. The current limit from Planck is FNL of 5, so everything in the gray region is excluded by Planck. Multi-field inflation would give us something that's bigger than 1, and single-field inflation is in that regime. With these LSST CMBS4 cross-correlations, we get these colored curves here, right? So we, depending on how large scales we can go, we can kind of probe that regime of FNL of order 1, which is interesting to distinguish between multi-field and single-field inflation. Now, these L-min here are very optimistic because there are systematics on large scales. There might be stars that are confused with galaxies. So it's probably very hard to get into the red regime. But even at L-min of 20, which is maybe doable, or should really be doable, I think, you might be able to probe FNL of 1.
How tight are these predictions? I mean, depends on the model potentially.
Oh yeah, sorry.
All this, that stuff.
Yeah.
Can we believe this? These actual numbers?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is.
Is this a prediction or not?
This is assuming a specific signature from inflation that's kind of so this is in this context of multi-field inflation that can produce that specific signature. And the, I guess for that model, the numbers from Planck are FNL of 5, right? And within that specific model, these are the numbers that we forecast.
All the other models?
All the other models, most of them cannot be probed with that signature. So you need other observables to look into those, right? So this is probably only a very specific type of primordial non-Gaussianity that's produced in specific models of inflation. But I guess the nice thing is that, I think that's right.
So why don't we believe that signature?
Oh, you don't, well, you can calculate it, and you know, for that specific model, for that specific model, you get that signature, and that's useful because you can test that specific model.
Yeah, this is the point is that they run measure this, and then either you're going to get zero or non-zero. Now, how you interpret that measurement is up to you. If you don't believe
in inflation. No, but I mean, if you don't see something, then it doesn't kill inflation.
No, it doesn't kill.
So it's not a prediction.
I think
it's a prediction for some subset of inflationary models.
Nothing kills
inflation. Well, maybe not. That's not what he's trying to do. He's just saying, let's rule it.
So, what's the improvement over just the galaxies or just the CMB alone?
Very good question. So so without the CMB lensing, we degrade by a factor of 10 to 20. But that kind of assumes on, that depends on the assumptions we put into these forecasts. So one assumption that I put into the forecast is that I allow the matter power spectrum to change in the same way as FNL changes the bias. So I kind of put in a degeneracy by hand that might not be there in reality, right? So within that specific parameterization, I find that CMB lensing helps by factor 10 or 20.
Sorry, can you elaborate on that? And there is no degeneracy.
Well, right. So that's so basically, I was too lazy to vary cosmological parameters, right? So then I said like the worst thing that could happen is that matter power spectrum changes in exactly the same way as FNL. Changes the galaxy
shapes,
bias.
Right, so
they have different shapes, but if they have the same shape, then we can't tell FNL from just the clustering. Yeah. Right?
But I guess I still understand. One has one over k squared and the other is so.
Yeah, right. But it's no. Yeah, you're right. They have very different shapes, right? But then the error bars are also kind of big here.
Mm.
So you can just about see the changes aren't very big. But I agree. It's maybe overly conservative to assume this worst case scenario where matter power spectrum changes the same way.
I'm saying it because I remember I just did this exercise a while back, just using galaxies, and I say the best you can go as low as the cosmic Brownian limit from galaxy 0.1. So you can get very close to one just from
I guess another way to interpret this is we wanted to look like what's the signal that really comes from that cross-correlation, right? I mean, let's say there's nothing from the autocorrelation. How much do we gain by looking at the cross-correlation? That's maybe the better way to say it. But yeah, I guess if you don't do that marginalization over cosmology, then LSST alone would also maybe get around FNL of 1. Right? Okay, then the improvement that we actually get from the sample variance cancellation is factor 1.5 to 2. And the way to test this is you can basically take the same surveys and assume that there's no sky overlap, right? And then you ask, like, how much better is it if you have sky overlap? Because then you're probing the same modes and you make that sample variance cancellation work. Then the large-scale galaxies are quite important. And also these dropout galaxies at high redshift are important because they improve that that cross-correlation coefficient between the galaxies and the CMB lensing, right? So that is kind of needed to properly do that sample variance cancellation. There are many challenges, I guess.
I'm surprised that the sample variance cancellation gives only this factor 1.5 to 2. Wouldn't you, like, if you look at the...
Yeah, you would expect a little bit more, I guess.
I would have think, if you look at this argument, like, if you have so many modes, and for all of them, you have
But you are fast, you are limited by Schaffner's larger scale, so that's the thing. So you would think that you're
that should do a lot, but in fact, you're limited because of the shape of the parachute, you're limited by shutters and all.
But at least the lensing mode doesn't have that problem, like, so the mode measurement of the lensing doesn't have
but
that, so you're careful.
Yeah, I mean, the improvement is given by that correlation coefficient, right? So it's 1 over 1 minus r squared. That's kind of the improvement factor. And if you plug in 95% correlation coefficient there, I think you expect like factor of 3 improvement. So we do a little bit worse than the expectation. I'm not sure why that is. Well, I mean, the other thing is like it's not so easy to tell what comes from sample variance cancellation and what doesn't, right? So what I'm quoting here is the difference between the case where the surveys observe in the same region of the sky compared to when they observe different regions of the sky, right? But if you observe different regions of the sky, you also observe a bigger volume, right? So you're kind of like you're taking away the sample variance cancellation, but you have more volume. So then it's not really clear that you know the difference you're seeing is just from sample variance cancellation. There's also like a volume factor that might give you another factor of 2, maybe. So I think it's not quite clear how to find out from the forecast which part is due to sample variance cancellation and which part is just you know from having a lot of information. We can chat more. Maybe have more ideas. So, yeah. But yeah, this is just like comparing sky overlap versus no sky overlap. Okay, then I guess we already briefly discussed that there are many challenges, right? Going to large scales is very difficult, especially in the galaxy surveys, but also for seeing lensing, it's challenging.
So, one more question.
Yeah.
So you say when the LSST you go to without this artificial kind of cosmology marginalization that you put, so this, if you would go to f and l equals 1 roughly, and with it you go to f and l equals 10 for LSST. So it's a huge degrade in signal to noise. And so you put in something that in the power spectrum that can go as 1 over k squared as the bias, right? Isn't there some kind of, wouldn't the original idea of the scale-dependent bias just that there cannot be a systematic for some symmetry reason that goes like this, or a cosmological effect that goes like this?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, one should probably redo this with proper marginalization over cosmology, where you shouldn't see that degradation. Yeah. So I guess the way this is really just, this is only looking for effect that comes from the difference between clustering and seam lensing. It might be overly conservative. In that sense. Yeah. So there's additional information if you assume that you can predict the matter power spectrum on large scales. I guess another issue you might have is like there might be GR corrections on these large scales. So these are also not folded in here, so yeah. Can go both ways. Okay, so I guess I briefly mentioned already that star contamination on large scales is an issue for galaxies. That's actually a big problem, but there might be ways to get rid of that by protecting out the modes that are aligned with the galaxy and only looking for modes that are in the other direction. Another issue is that there might be catastrophic redshift errors where you confuse low redshift and high redshift galaxies, and that can potentially be a big problem because you might see a lot of stuff on large scales at redshifts that you think are high redshifts, but actually they're low redshift galaxies that are, misidentified and go to and you think they are high redshifts. So that can lead to confusion. But what we kind of find is that if you assume some simple model for this catastrophic redshift errors, some simple parameterization, then that doesn't seem to be a problem. But the big assumption is here that you need to know the global number density of the galaxies. We can discuss more later if you like. We can do more. We can also measure matter amplitude at different redshifts. The idea here is galaxies are proportional to galaxy bias and amplitude of the matter fluctuations. So if both are unknown, so if you don't know B1 and sigma 8, you only measure this, then there's a perfect degeneracy between the two. If you have these cross correlations with seam lensing, doesn't see the galaxy bias, right? So you get you can break that degeneracy between B1 and sigma 8 by having these two power spectra. And it turns out that works really well. So you can measure sigma 8 at sub-percent precision if you can go to small angular scales. Of course, that depends on how well you can model the nonlinear regime. You can also measure bias. I should finish up that first part. Yeah. So I think I think I've shown all I wanted to say was basically that steam lensing cross LSST clustering is very promising to measure primordial longer sanity and growth of structure. And for FNL, the problem is to go to large scales. For measuring the growth and sigma 8, the problem are small nonlinear scales. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the second part of the talk, where I'm trying to address how we can maybe do better on the small scales.
When you determine the matter power spectrum, the correlation of pairs of galaxies, you need to know sigma 8 and to fit to the data.
So this was the forecast was showing how well we can measure sigma 8 if we don't assume anything about it, right? So the data would tell us sigma 8. But I might talk more about this later. So let me come to the second part of the talk. So I already said that one of the motivations why we want to go into this nonlinear regime is that we can measure sigma 8 better, right? Because we just have more modes. But there is a simpler motivation even. So basically, if you remember that acoustic peak, the acoustic scale that we saw in the CMB in the first couple of slides, that's not only imprinted in the CMB, but it's also imprinted in the galaxies at lower redshift. Now, the nice thing is that these galaxies are observed at different redshifts, right? And that acoustic peak is, or the preferred clustering always happens at the same physical distance. So now you can look at the angular extent of that physical separation at different redshift, and that allows you to measure distance, right? So basically, you can ask, what's the angular extent of that physical separation of 150 megaparsec? You do it at different redshifts, and that gives you a measurement of distance as a function of redshift. That probes the growth history of the universe, so the expansion rate, so you can get measurements of Hubble parameter this way, right? And this goes under the name of BAO measurements. This has been detected in data, and it's very nice measurements. And to say why the nonlinear scales are important here, let me go a little bit more into the physics, how this BAO scale is imprinted in the galaxies. Basically, in the very early universe, you have this you have baryons and photons tightly coupled to each other, right? They undergo these acoustic oscillations. That happens until decoupling, when photons and electrons are cool enough that the electrons can go together with the protons and form hydrogen. The photons kind of free stream outwards, baryons stay in place, and the place where these baryons stay in place is essentially given by the distance the sound wave travels from the Big Bang until decoupling. Right, and it turns out that distance is given by the 150 megaparsec that I mentioned earlier on. Now, if you were able to observe galaxies at that time, then the preferred separation would be 150 megaparsec in each patch of the sky. However, we observe galaxies at much lower redshifts, so this kind of nice linear signal is distorted and destroyed a little bit. And I'm going to illustrate this here using a video from Nikhil Padmanabhan. Right, so this is a simple toy example where you have some galaxies here in the center, and then you have a lot of galaxies around here separated by 150 megaparsec from that central part. Now, you can, and then this is in the early universe where, you know, this preferred separation is very clean. Now, you can ask what happens if nonlinear structure formation happens, where basically all these galaxies move around. First, there can be displacements that are on very large scales where the whole thing basically shifts to the left or right, and that won't change the BAO scale, right? Because you're moving the entire thing, so the BAO scale will still be the same everywhere. However, there can also be motions on kind of these scales where galaxies might move inwards or they might move outwards in different regions, right? And then that can lead to a degradation of the BAO scale. Right, so this is shown here. So right, this is basically evolving forward this initial conditions. As I said, you can see that some of the galaxies move outwards from the ring and other galaxies move inward, right? So now if you measure the BAO scale in this whole ring and you average over the ring, what will happen is you degrade your BAO scale, right? And this is the same as what I mentioned earlier in the CMB lensing, right? You have different modulation in different locations. So basically you degrade your acoustic peak by some extent, right? And the amount by which you degrade it is given by the dispersion, how much you disperse around the mean as you walk around here. Now, what you can do is you can undo some of that dispersion by moving galaxies back to where you think they came from, right? And this is kind of illustrated here. So this is a method that has been proposed by Daniel Eisenstein and collaborators in 2007, where they basically go to every point, they estimate the potential of that distribution of galaxies that they observe, and they move it back along that potential, right? And then what you recover is something that's closer to the initial peak, where you have the same BAO scale in every patch of the universe. This has been demonstrated on data and works very well, and typically you get improvements by a factor of 1.5 to 2 on BAO measurements. Okay, so I guess getting back to that question, what can we do about nonlinear dynamics? There are several things we might want to do, right? So one thing we can do is we can try to do better analytical models where we just where we try to model this nonlinear stuff on small scales. A second approach is to simulate these nonlinearities in small scales and don't do any analytical modeling in between, right? And then just see if from the simulations we can extract information from small scales. A third way is the one I just showed, where you transform the data in a way that you reduce nonlinearities, right? This is what this moving back is doing. It's kind of making the galaxy distribution more linear. Or fourth approach is you can measure a non-Gaussian tail of the probability distribution and try to learn something about cosmology from the nonlinear regime. In the rest of the talk, I'll only talk about this this third part where I transform the data by doing these reconstruction techniques to try and get at the linear initial conditions. Right, so this is the setup. We have some linear initial conditions in the early universe. Then there's nonlinear dynamics where dark matter collapses and galaxies form. That leads to the observed galaxy distribution. And what we want to do is we want to reconstruct that back to the initial conditions. There are several paradigms how one might do that. The first one I already mentioned, right? You just estimate potentials and you move things backward. And there are several groups working on this. So Daniel Eisenstein and Nikhil Padmanabhan were the first ones to apply this to BOS data. And recently there has been more interest in this by Uli Penn at CETA and Matthias Elriaga, Svetlin Tassev, and also myself. This is kind of the easiest thing you can do. Then you can do something that's a bit more complicated, where you don't do this backward step, but what you do instead is you sample initial conditions. You sample these initial conditions. You go forward in a simulation. You compare against the data. If it's good, you keep the initial conditions. If it's bad, you iterate back, and then you kind of go in this loop where you resample the initial conditions in such a way that you get something that agrees with the observed galaxy distribution if you model it forward. And this is kind of this forward modeling and sampling that Jens Jasche and Ben Wandelt are working on very intensely for the past 10 years or so. And finally, there's a third paradigm that's has been proposed very recently by the Berkeley group, where they replace the sampling by an optimization technique. So they're saying you have some simulation that brings you from the initial conditions to the observed galaxy distribution. Then you can write down a likelihood what the initial conditions are, and you can kind of solve for the maximum maximum a posteriori of the initial conditions and get a map of the initial conditions. And that seems to work quite well, but it's technically extremely complicated. I think their argument would be that it's computationally more tractable, because the parameter space that you have to sample is many million dimensions, and they do special Hamiltonian sampling techniques that kind of they hope would give them. Well, that makes this tractable, right? But you always have to assume some model for structure formation, and that's usually not realistic. So then, yeah, it's not clear if what you get is correct.
If you don't have a model for structure formation, then you cannot do this.
So, yeah, right. But the idea here is that you can use a full N-body simulation, whereas they have only shown this for 2LPT or solidology approximation. Well, yeah, so they are now looking, well, I mean, I think they're also working on full N-bodies. I mean, And none of these are really full in body. I mean, they use like PM simulations, I guess. So it's, yeah.
Could you again explain the number three? How does it work? Is that
the bottom one? Yes. Yeah, so they so what they do is they write down a likelihood for having some initial. So you have like some initial Gaussian random field. Then you run a simulation that brings you to the observed galaxy distribution. Then you can. Right, so then you have a likelihood for what the observed galaxy distribution is. You can given that likelihood, you can solve for what the initial condition field should look like. And the idea is that, I mean, this is not an analytical modeling, but you're really kind of inverting the simulation. So they use some optimization methods to kind of solve for the best initial conditions given that likelihood for the observed galaxy. But it's very complicated. I don't think anybody under, I mean, I don't understand it perfectly. yeah, but they are working very hard on this, and it looks very promising and nice. How am I doing on time?
Are you on 10 minutes?
Okay, great. So I will not talk about these two here. I will just talk about this first one because that's what I ended up working on. Right, and to kind of motivate what we do here, let me show you this simple one-dimensional example where we assume that the initial field is just given by particles that are spaced equally in space. And then they evolve to their final positions here, shown by these vectors. Right? So basically, this would be your initial conditions from inflation, and this would be the observed galaxy positions in a 1D example. Now, what are the nonlinearities that happen? The first nonlinearity is that this displacement that goes from initial to final positions, that displacement field is nonlinear in the initial conditions, right? So you have this part that's linear, but then you have this nonlinear correction for the displacement field. Now, it turns out that's not too bad. We can model that pretty well, right? So that's not really a problem. And perturbative modeling is very good. However, the more tricky nonlinearity is this kind of shell crossing that's happening here, where galaxies kind of that are here end up somewhere else, and you know, different trajectories cross each other. If we don't know the velocities, or even if we know the velocities back here, we cannot really tell how many crossings happened. So from the final position of particles, we cannot tell where the particles came from. So this is destroying information, right? It makes the problem not invertible, essentially. There are different initial conditions that map to the same final positions. So that seems like that seems like something that completely destroys memory of initial conditions whenever this shell crossing happens.
Well, you said also when we know the velocities.
I guess if we know the velocities, if everything went on straight lines, then yes, we could do it. But if there's more than one crossing, then again, you can't tell. So you can't tell if there's one, two, or three crossings, even if you know velocity.
Well, I mean, technically, you could just solve the equation backwards.
Yeah.
But I mean, in practice, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess then the argument would be that it's maybe chaotic, right? And yeah, like tiny differences could make more or less shell crossings happen.
Well, if it's actually chaotic, you can't.
Yeah, then
maybe that's impossible.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is what I would expect generically. So.
Yeah. I mean, the Berkeley group hopes that it's not chaotic, right? So they hope to predict how many shell crossings happen.
Planets in the solar system are chaotic, but not this.
I mean, it's not clear if it's chaotic, right? I mean, it's a deterministic. I mean, the embodied simulation that goes from here to here is deterministic, right? So it doesn't have to be chaotic. I mean, we think of it that way because, I mean, I don't know, it looks messy, right? But it doesn't have to be chaotic.
I think the key point is that chaos is well defined in a very long time. But if things don't last very long, and I mean, here you're talking about several orbits at most,
right? Yeah, right.
Then, I mean, it doesn't mean.
I guess I don't understand that.
I mean, chaos is something you look, I mean, for things that are very close and wait for a very long time and see whether that's
exponential. Well, if you wait for some period of time, then you could ask.
But so how long that time is you compare to the dynamical.
Well, I mean, okay, so you know, some measure, I'm not an expert on this. You say, okay, I have this much time, and then I'm, you know, I am
right.
Correspondingly X sensitive to initial conditions.
So I'm saying that if that ratio is not very big, then, the fact that it's chaotic is not a big problem.
Yeah, if in some sense it were mildly chaotic.
Mildly chaotic, yeah, I guess that's
right. good. Sure. Well, it's only a minor wave problem.
Yeah, I guess we don't know if we really lose information about initial conditions, but naively it looks like it's very difficult to get the initial conditions, right? So I guess it's still an open problem. What we do is we say, okay, let's you know, say we give up on that. Let's say we can't predict what happens when shell crossing happens, right? So what we do is we just reconstruct the displacement that assumes that there's no shell crossing. Okay, so just quickly, so the simplest reconstruction you can do is, as I already mentioned, is like you measure the potential of that final particle distribution, you move galaxies back along that potential, and that's what's being done in this original reconstruction paper from 2007. Now what we do is slightly different, so basically we say, you know, let's say we have this final distribution, what is the mapping that brings us back to some uniform initial conditions if there's no shell crossing, right? And there is a unique solution for that in 1D. Then we know that that displacement is a pretty linear quantity, so we can estimate the linear density just by taking the divergence of that displacement.
I think I lost something. So when you say initial, what redshift are you talking about?
Let's say redshift 100 or so. Right, so like really the initial Gaussian field.
So it is after the galaxies obviously have formed, right? So
oh no, this is like really early on. This is like,
yeah,
this is.
So then even identification of what counts as a galaxy today and what was in the initial surface, would that also?
Yeah, so this is the goal, right? So these are galaxies that we observe today, and this is the dark matter distribution at redshift 100, say.
So what I'm saying, there's no particle there, right? You're taking like some peaks of the dark matter distribution and into some peaks in the galaxy surface.
That's right. You would do this at the density field level. You wouldn't really do it at the objects level, I guess. Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. Yeah. Okay, so now the question is like, you know, technically, how do you get from that distribution here to that initial distribution? And there are different ways to do that. The first was proposed by Uli Penn and this group, where they say, let's put some mesh lines through the observed distribution and distort the mesh until you get a uniform density. And that's what they do to get the displacement from of the nonlinear galaxies back to the uniform distribution. And they do this in a very clever way, where they have like some coordinate transformation that that distorts the coordinates in some way so that never shell crossing never happens. Now, what we do is a slightly different approach, but similar idea, where we say we estimate this Lubacz displacement in the same way like the usual reconstruction works. But we first do this on very large scales to kind of get coherence on kind of large patches of the sky and large scales, and then we zoom in and decrease the smoothing scale and do displacements on smaller scales. But the idea is the same. We try to get the displacement that brings us from a uniform distribution to that observed galaxy distribution. This is how this works in practice. So this here would be initial conditions. This is just from a simulation. This would be the observed galaxy distribution. For simplicity, I'm just showing the nonlinear dark matter here. And then this is what the reconstruction does. So in the first step, it kind of reconstructs the field on large scales. And then as you do more and more iterations, you recover the small scale structure. And after 8 steps or so, there's not much change anymore. Now these are just nice pictures. You can look at this more quantitatively, where you look at the correlation coefficient of the reconstructed density and the initial density. So here is no correlation, this is 100% correlation. These are large scales, these are small scales. So you see if you don't do any reconstruction, you're correlated with initial conditions on large scales, but then that correlation drops on smaller scales. If you do standard reconstruction, you improve this, so you can see more of the initial conditions towards smaller scales.
Standard reconstruction is?
This is one step Seldovich. So this is what happens with this new reconstruction, where we iteratively do the Seldovich step and decrease the smoothing scale. So you see we can get 90% correlation with initial conditions up to k of 0.4 or 5. You can also ask what's the relative error we are making compared to the signal. And so here the lower the better. So the error is very small on large scales with new reconstruction that we're doing. And then it becomes kind of bigger until we can't do anything on the very small scales. You can also look at baryon acoustic oscillations, not in the galaxies, and what we find is that you can recover the linear BAO perfectly within cosmic baryons. So maybe this plot is worth explaining. So basically what is shown here are 10 simulations, and each simulation BAO scale is slightly different from the mean because of cosmic baryons in that finite volume. So this would be the initial BAO. Then galaxies evolve, so this would be the BAO that you see in the final condition. So you see there's this scrambling up because the galaxies get moved around. If you do standard reconstruction, you get closer to what the input was, but not perfectly. There's still some dispersion here. However, with this new reconstruction that we've proposed, you basically recover the initial conditions perfectly, at least in the simulations that assume basically no shot noise. So these are kind of idealized simulations, but still, you know, if there's no shot noise, we can perfectly recover the linear BAO. You can also measure the power spectrum of the reconstructed density, and that's also closer to the linear.
So this is just
linear.
For dark matter field?
Yeah, that's right.
So the actual gas.
Yes, yeah. I'll get back to that. Yeah, so this is all only for dark matter particles where there's no shot noise, which is not realistic. There will be much more noise in practice, which is a big problem. Right, you can also get the power spectrum, and that also agrees somewhat better with the linear power spectrum. And you get a very simple shape for the reconstructed power spectrum. Right. Now, yeah, as I said, there's no shot noise in here, so we need to include that. And we need to do something about the fact that we don't observe dark matter, we observe halos and galaxies. We observe galaxies. And that's something that we've been working on for the last year or so, and it's tricky, but we hope to have some results soon on what one can do. Naively, what one can do is one can just apply that reconstruction that we proposed to the galaxies. But for realistic shot noise, the reconstruction is not very useful. Right? So we're kind of disappointed by that. So that's why we try to come up with better ways to improve the reconstruction to actually do something even if shot noise is high. But it's still to be seen if that actually works. And then there are a lot of more complications, right? So there are retrospace distortions that makes it more complicated to estimate the potential. And then there's a survey mask, so there might be holes in the survey. There's different depths in different regions, so there's inhomogeneous noise. Right, so that's something that, that's interesting to look more into. And I think that's all solvable, but it's maybe technically complicated. And then I guess one of the big questions is what happens to primordial non-Gaussianity, right? So let's say we have some primordial non-Gaussianity, we do the reconstruction. The hope would be that the reconstruction only removes the non-Gaussianity that comes from gravitational clustering, but it doesn't touch this primordial non-Gaussianity, which couples very large scales to very small scales. So that would be something that would be very interesting to look into, and we hope to do that soon. But at the moment, we are trying to work out how to deal with galaxies. Okay, so let me conclude. So in the second part of the talk, I showed that nonlinear physics is kind of limiting the science return of galaxy surveys, and reconstruction can reduce that degradation somewhat. We showed in these zero-noise simulations, we can do very well, so we can get 95% of the linear information up to KF 0.35. BAO signal-to-noise is improved by a factor of 2.7 to 2.5, again in these noise-free simulations. And the improvement over the standard reconstruction method is 30 to 70%, depending on redshift. If we can apply this to real data, it will improve a lot of the cosmology that these surveys are after. And let me stop here.
Let me just say, I would say nonlinear physics doesn't limit the science from the galaxy area. It is the science return of the galaxy area. So it's slightly different point of view. Just before I take questions, we're going to have lunch afterwards and in the bistro, but it's going to be a super dinner at 6, so everybody's welcome to join. So, questions, Matt?
So, the shell crossing issue, I mean, I guess you've kind of shown that it's kind of irrelevant, I mean, at least on the scales that you probe, right? If you get 95% correlation with the initial density field, I mean, is it that it's just sort of...
Well, no, I think it just happens in smaller scales.
Yeah.
And I mean, it depends. I mean, like this, you know, here you have like 80% correlation coefficient, which you think might be good, but maybe it's actually really bad, right? It depends on the application that you have. So, yeah, I think there is shell crossing, it's just happening on smaller scales. I guess here you can see it better. This is a log K plot.
Okay.
Right? So you see here the error is like 10% or more. So, and you don't get any. So if this line is 1, that means you have nothing about initial conditions, right? And that happens at k of 0.7.8, right? So shell crossing is there, it just happens on small scales.
You said some naive estimate of when you expect it to be important, is that?
I guess like 0.7. I guess in that kind of regime. I mean, it depends on like how, there will always be some modes affected by shell crossing. Question is like, how many modes do you want to be affected by that to say like, no, shell crossing is the dominant piece or not? I guess if there was no shell crossing, in principle, that curve could stay down here all the way.
Right.
Because that's the main error I think we're making.
A lot of this depends on how many galaxies you count.
Yeah.
The number of galaxies counted in surveys is 10 times better than it used to be.
Yeah, that's right. But it's still not good enough. Yeah. We need many more galaxies to make this work.
Particularly the depth of the Baryon oscillation in a small scale region. And if it goes like n to some power, n is number of galaxies, n to the 3/2 or 1/2, you need a lot of galaxies.
Yeah, yeah.
You're way far away from, say, properly have the depth of the Baryon oscillations.
Well, I mean, these measurements of the...
It's measuring the amount of dark matter in halos.
Yeah, I mean, these baryonic acoustic oscillations in the galaxies, they're measured now with like 1% accuracy, right? So the scale of the oscillation is measured to 1% accuracy. And this is with current data, right?
So if you get more galaxies. Well, the depth of the oscillation. Because if you remove the dark matter, that the transfer function is a uni-oscillating Bessel function. So if you work it out, you can determine how many galaxies you need to see the depth of the uni-oscillating, just baryons, okay?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand. I think on large scales, what we can say, I think the galaxies are just some linear biased, times the dark matter. So the BAO that we see in the galaxy should be the same as in the dark matter, roughly.
We don't see dark matter, so we...
Right, but we can model the...
We have to know from how much dark matter there is, okay?
Yes.
We have a model that relates the dark matter to the galaxies. Yeah,
but
and within that model...
We have a different model.
And that model agrees... Yeah, yeah, no, sure. I mean, this is model dependent. We assume lambda CDM everywhere.
Different models.
Well, it would be interesting to do this for different models as well. Yeah, sure.
So I have a different model I can predict them better.
Yeah.
But I need a lot of galaxies.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone needs a lot of galaxies.
Is there, maybe you showed at the moment I was out, but is there something similar for the other two methods that you discussed, like the thing now by Urosh with the likelihood reconstruction, or the thing by Ben Wandel, do they have a similar?
Oh, you mean if they also have these?
Something like that.
Yeah, so I think the Berkeley group does make similar plots. They, for some reason, they don't want to show this 1 minus correlation coefficient squared, so what they show is usually this plot.
Mm-hmm.
And so at low k you can't really tell because everything looks like 1, but then at high k I think they do a bit better than we do, which is kind of expected, right? Because they use like a full simulation. We just use some simple moving thing.
If it actually works, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think that they will have another paper very soon, which is apparently very impressive. So.
So if you assume the Zeldovich approximation, then you can smooth your initial conditions at a certain scale, and then you can calculate the probability of shell crossing happening.
Yeah.
So how does the transition when shell crossing becomes big in the Zeldovich approximation relate to the point at which this reconstruction starts to fail at small scales?
I guess it would be the same. I think if you use the Zeldovich approximation to predict how much shell crossing happens, that would be a very good approximation. I mean, no, I don't think anybody has done that, but it would be a very interesting calculation to do. Yeah, I agree.
Other questions, Marcel?